is a man on the moon, and he's slowly going mad. Or is he? On the desolate surface of the moon, mining contractor Sam Bell is in the final weeks of his 3-year term. Utterly alone, with only the complex's robotic overseer, Gertie, as his companion, Sam has made his existence as bearable as possible, watching old TV transmissions, tending to a small garden, and working out. Everything runs smoothly, if routinely, until Sam begins to see things. Is he losing his mind, or has another person made his presence known? Moon stars Sam Rockwell in what must be the ultimate challenge for an actor, spending the story's entire length as the only person on screen. Man. Moon is the feature film directorial debut of Duncan Jones, whose previous work has comprised commercials and short films. Joining us now, the director of Moon, Duncan Jones. Thanks for joining us on Celluloid Dreams.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here.
This film is about the human condition. It's loneliness, alienation, love, yearning, and the eternal question, who am I, played against the mentality and ethic, if you will, of the modern multi-billion dollar corporation. That says so much, and there's so much to explore there.
I think, we tried to limit the amount of politics involved. It was really more about the personal story than it was about the sort of global political story. But I think there was a nice little sort of tongue-in-cheek moment that we had in that this company, which is sort of fairly nefarious, or at least appears to be up front, is a green energy company.
Right.
So the idea really being that even the greenest company with the best intentions at heart is still always going to be slightly profit driven, and they're going to have to cut corners, or believe they have to cut corners where they can. And then unfortunately in our film's case, it's Sam is one of the corners they need to cut.
Yeah. In various places you've cited as inspirational films 2001, Alien, Outland, which sadly has been, forgotten by so many people, and I think is still a terrific movie. Peter Hyams, of course.
Absolutely. Outland's a fantastic film.
Also, Silent Running. To that list, I would add Solaris, both the original and the remake.
Yeah.
And even the film your father was in, The Man Who Fell to Earth. I mean, I see a lot of that stuff. And they're all films from 30 years or more ago. Why do you think that is?
I think there's been a bit of an embarrassment in science fiction in the filmmaking community about the kind of science fiction that people want to watch. And I think it's okay, it's sort of acceptable to go out and see a science fiction film which is filled with special effects and strange new worlds and amazing visual vistas. But I think if you ever try and do anything which is about really interesting, maybe slightly more challenging questions, there's sort of an embarrassment that's really not the venue for science fiction. And I think we've lost the seriousness that we used to accept in science fiction from 30 years ago, where we would ask much more sort of important human questions.
And, many films purport to do that today, but it's interesting because it's like a faux human element and more of an excuse to do cool special effects. I think so.
And I think, I'm as excited about the new J.J. Abrams Star Trek film as anyone. I think it's fantastic fun. But I think there is still a place out there to do science fiction which maybe delves into different aspects of the future. And maybe where it's not about the technology and it's not about the special effects. Although those will have to be there to tell the story.
Yeah.
It's about the human beings and how those future environments are going to affect human beings and how, how we fit into that future world.
So many people that I talk to and what I read online and in magazines, people think of any genre films from before the 90s as quaint, out of date, or otherwise irrelevant, and that just kills me, because as time goes on, they're looked upon less and less favorably, which I guess is part of the excuse for all the remakes that we see.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think those movies, like you're saying, they have something. There's heart there, and they do touch on the human condition in ways that too many, I don't want to be down on all modern movies, but too many modern movies just don't do.
Well, I think we have an economic system which values the new over necessarily the good. So sometimes, sometimes it works in your favor, and sometimes a remake gets made of a film which maybe wasn't so great, or which has dated in a way. But a lot of great films still stand up. I mean, I don't think there's anything that needs to be improved in Alien. I think that
Nothing.
Film works as it is.
Yeah.
And I think Blade Runner is still a fantastic film and doesn't need remaking. It doesn't mean that for someone like myself, who is a huge fan of those films, I don't wish those films, you know, there was more in the canon. There were more films like that I could watch,
right.
Which is why I tried to make a film which was original, but at the same time, you know, appreciated and tried to recognize what the aspects of those old films, which I love so much, and bring them back for a new audience.
Yeah. You know, as a sidebar, I want to point out that, you know, the show Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Oh, yeah.
One of the films they made fun of was The Incredible Shrinking Man.
Yeah.
That's just absolutely wrongheaded to me. There's nothing cheesy about that movie.
Yeah, I think maybe that was almost just the title was enough to make them think that was a fit place to go.
It's just so sad. All right, let's talk about designing the world of Moon, because there's, as I say, so many things to discuss about this film. You're talking about an indie budget, yet you're making a sort of a big yet intimate science fiction film. Where do you start?
Well, I was incredibly fortunate. I have one of my best buddies who I've been working with for years and years is a concept artist called Gavin Rothery. And both he and I were, you know, we have the same love of science fiction, the same history of science fiction. We were both grew up on a British comic book called 2000 AD, which is sort of the heavy metal equivalent of the UK.
Oh, Judge Dredd, right?
Judge Dredd was from there. The original Judge Dredd, not the one from the film, which is very different. The original Judge Dredd and a number of other characters. And the depiction of science fiction in that was very gritty and had the same kind of chunkiness that we tried to go after
in this film.
Yeah. But also there was guys like Ron Cobb and Sid Mead and Douglas Trumbull's films. You know, all of those things very much were huge influences on what we wanted to do.
Cobb designed Alien, Sid Mead designed Blade Runner.
Exactly. Right. And In fact, different parts of the base sort of borrow from different designers and different films. There's a section of the base called the Infirmary, which is very much us trying to do the Sid Mead look, you know, with all of the strange jutting angles and try and create something that would kind of fit into his portfolio. So
you wrote this film specifically for Sam Rockwell, I understand.
That's right, yeah. I was very lucky. I had the opportunity to meet up with Sam about 3 years ago. He'd very much liked a script that I'd submitted to him because I wanted him to do my first film. And unfortunately, that project wasn't going to work out. But we got on really well, and we started talking about the kinds of films that we loved and the science fiction films that we've just been mentioning. And Sam said that he really wanted to play a blue-collar guy, you know, like the sort of Bruce Dern role in Silent Running and, you know, like Sean Connery in Outland and those kind of films. And there were things that I knew that I wanted to do in a first feature, and I desperately wanted to work with Sam in my first film. So I said, look, why don't you just give me some time, and I'll write something specifically for you. And if you promise me you'll read it, let's work that way. So I went away and I wrote a story for him, and I teamed up with a guy called Nathan Parker, and he wrote the first couple of drafts of the screenplay. And then I worked on it and then sent it out to Sam, and he really liked it. It took him a while to read it. It took me about 9 months from that first meeting to the time I had a script for him. And then it took about 3 months from him receiving it to actually say yes, because he was doing Frost Nixon at the time. And I know it was actually, you know, it was a big decision for him because it's a lot of responsibility for him as an actor.
Yes.
And a lot of... you know, he's putting a lot of his career in my hands as a first-time director on something incredibly technical and very challenging, you know, for a director and an actor. So I think it was a big decision that he had to make to actually do it. And I'll be forever grateful that he gave me the opportunity to let me work with him on it.
Yeah, and I want to talk more about that in just a second. But the challenge of writing, did you start with a set of parameters at the writing stage that guided you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was Machiavellian. I mean, we had so many things that we were trying to manipulate and do with this first film. You know, we knew that we wanted to make a film which didn't look like a little British film. We knew that we needed to shoot it in a soundstage because we wanted a completely controlled environment. We knew that there was very specific special effects that we could get the most bang for the buck out of.
Mm.
We knew that we wanted to keep our cast small. So there were all of these things that we knew before the story was even written. And then it was a matter of coming up with something which maximized each one of these elements and tell a story which played to our strengths.
Mm. Now, you shot at Shepperton Studios, which is where Ridley Scott filmed Alien.
Absolutely.
Which had to be a trip in and of itself.
Yeah, well, the moon base that we built was actually... We had two sound stages, but the moon base was the bigger of the sets, and that was built in the same sound stage as Nostromo.
Oh, wow.
And our claim to fame is that our base was slightly bigger than the Nostromo set.
Wow, and on an indie budget, no less. Yeah. Damn, that's an accomplishment. So, is this true? I read that it was basically one enclosed set. You could actually walk through it like it was a ship?
It was fantastic. I mean, we have footage of it when we were still building it, and it was just an amazing place. It was like going on location. You know, we sort of would go into the base through the airlock in the mornings. They would lock us in, and then, you know, until lunch break, we would be in the base. And it was incredibly, I think, useful for Sam, because when we were in there, he didn't have to worry about third walls or anything like that. He was in the base, other than the crew, who all, you know, we were all hairy and looking like we were for the 70s. And, you know, it was a real mind f**k. I'm sorry. I've got to take this one out. But it was a real, you know, unique situation for him as an actor. You know, it put him in a place where I don't think we could have got there any other way.
I think Joss Whedon did that with the ship in Serenity, where
he created
a full walk-around thing. So you have lots of footage that might show up on the DVD of, like, a tour through the set, I hope?
We got some great stuff, yeah. We had this early on, before we even built the set, we have an animatic where the camera kind of floats through what is going to become the base. And then, yeah, we have lots of raw footage of it being built and things like that. So all sorts of things might sneak onto the DVD.
So as a sci-fi geek, man, that just totally rocks my world. I love that stuff.
Absolutely.
Did you manage to keep any neat pieces from the set?
There's quite a few props. I think my producer, thinking ahead, managed to keep some of the airlock doors, but I don't know where he's got them, so I'll have to ask him someday.
I'm watching that going, I would have one of these doors as the entrance to my house or my bedroom or something.
Yeah.
It's so freaking cool. We're talking with Duncan Jones. He is the director of Moon, starring Sam Rockwell. Awesome, awesome film. One of the best of the summer so far. So this actually has as its basis the very real possibility of the thinking behind colonizing other worlds, right?
Absolutely. We tried to base it in at least some theoretical ideas of how lunar colonization would occur. There was a great book by an author, Robert Zubrin, called Entering Space, which was all about, you know, how would you go about colonizing the solar system in a way which makes it financially viable. And one of the arguments made for lunar colonization was that there is actually a plentiful supply of something called helium-3 there. And helium-3 is a raw material, a fuel that could be used for cold fusion,
right?
A theoretical form of clean burning energy.
Right. I was going to ask you about that. So there's so far to go here. Okay, so let's stay with the scientific then for a moment. When you were in college, you studied a lot of this very scientific stuff, and I think this is so interesting. You studied philosophy and applying artificial intelligence and morality to sentient machines. Is that correct?
It is. It was a little premature. I don't think we need it quite yet, but it was something I was interested in, and you know, I had the opportunity to sort of delve into some areas which I found interesting, especially from science fiction, which was, you know, how do you apply morality or ethics, or do you ever need to apply morality or ethics to a machine which passes the Turing test or which appears to be sentient? Machines and also animals as well. You know, you could sort of go into animal ethics and the kind of things that Peter Singer writes about, and sort of how you the differentiation between treating different classes of animal and the different levels of sentience that they have, and how much responsibility we have as basically their carers on the planet. But I wanted to sort of extrapolate into machines and the work that Daniel Dennett was doing at Berkeley, I think. I think Daniel Dennett's there.
Sounds vaguely familiar.
But he sort of has this argument of something called functional equivalence, which is where if something, a machine, behaves in a human manner, very similar to the Turing test, if it behaves in a way where we are forced to deal with it as if it has sentience, then it's our moral duty to give it all of the same rights and treat it in a way as if it were a sentient being.
Interesting. And isn't that the whole precept of artificial intelligence to start with, that we give machines not only the ability to process information, but to make informed decisions based on, you know, a multitude of factors, which increasingly as time goes on, though I was much more optimistic as a kid, I'm thinking it's probably not going to happen, or not for much longer than we anticipated.
You know, the last couple of years have been startling, the developments that's been going on in robotics. Not to get too deeply into it, but there's things that I think DARPA is working on. There's a machine called Big Dog, which is it's basically a cargo hauling robot for the army, which looks like a headless dog. And basically, it's a machine which has a set of legs, which are all independently, able to work out the terrain that they're walking over. And if you actually see footage of this thing, if you look up Big Dog on YouTube, you can see footage of this thing, and it looks like an animal. It's very bizarre, huh. And you're actually starting to see robots which are no longer obviously manufactured looking. They're actually starting to look organic and having really strange, quirky behaviors. And I think that for me is the first stage where you have to say, we're getting to a point now where robotics are really on the cusp of something interesting, and we're going to have to start being aware of where they're going to have to fit into our world and how we're going to have to fit our lives around them.
Yeah. Well, interesting. We're talking with Duncan Jones, the director of Moon. So one of the talking points here has to be that, you know, your dad is David Bowie and you grew up in that world.
Yeah, he is.
Which I imagine, because you didn't have any other stuff to relate to, did it seem normal to you? Or have you gotten some comparison in the years since of, like, what that might have been like or how it might have been perceived?
I don't know. All I can say is that, you know, kids think whatever is the environment they grow up in is the natural way things should be.
Is the norm, yeah.
and that was the same for me. I mean, I grew up in a very unique time and place, and I was surrounded by creative elements all over the place, and listening to interesting music. But for me, what was more important was I was seeing interesting films and
visuals.
I was always more interested in visual things
because his music videos have a lot of cool
Absolutely.
Stuff going on.
Yeah, and my dad and I were very close, so he was always showing me films probably before I should be seeing them. And I remember seeing Clockwork Orange when I was way too young.
Oh, that was before it was banned, probably.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
So I was influenced by all sorts of things, but he was incredibly careful to make sure that I always understood what it was that I was watching.
Oh, neat.
So I was, you know, I was well educated on the film side of things, I think.
And he tried to get you into music, but what, it didn't take.
It just did not take. That was always my big rebellion. Is I just refused.
Well,
to
you
be
have to have some rebellion from the parents.
Yeah.
So
I took, I think, every instrument under the sun. I took lessons in, and I just wouldn't stick with any of them. So so I ended up doing film and playing lots of sports and chasing after girls and those kind of things.
Huh. Well, I guess it hasn't happened yet, but there's still a possibility you might shoot music videos for your dad. So.
Maybe. I don't know. You know, that's always possible. I think I need to get a few things under my belt and feel confident with myself doing film before I work with my dad.
Well, lucky you, because you grew up as the son of Bowie, you got to go on the sets of Labyrinth and
Absolutely.
The Hunger.
Absolutely. Labyrinth, Hunger, Absolute Beginners, which maybe not be everyone's favorite film, but
oh, right.
from a production design standpoint, the sets that were built for that film were extraordinary.
Julian Temple, right?
Yes, yeah. That's right. And he had one of the largest sound stages, I think, in the UK that was a recreation of Soho in London from the 1950s. And it was about three square blocks of a city inside a soundstage. It was the most amazing place.
Huh.
You know what? If I went back there now, it probably wasn't that big, but that's how I remember it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's all that really mattered is it was those kind of sets and just how overwhelming they were that had such a huge effect on me. And I remember thinking how cool it was that this was, you know, this was someone who was going to get the chance to document something, you know, to create a vision of a world, and then that world was going to disappear, and he was going to be the only person who ever showed it. So that was kind of something I always thought was really kind of cool.
Magical.
Yeah.
So I gather that you actually learned a lot about filmmaking on the set of The Hunger when, and correct me if I'm wrong, Tony Scott lets you kind of run wild with a camera in shooting footage that might make it into the film?
I was there on the original Hunger briefly, but I was actually, the time that I got to work on The Hunger was much later on, when Tony Scott did, there was a television show called The Hunger, And my my father came in and did the sort of introductions to each episode. So there was like a 2 week shooting period where Tony was shooting all of the introductions to the various episodes and did an episode with my father. And I came and worked on the set, so I was a bit older. But that was really another one of those sort of epiphany moments where I was had the chance to work closely with Tony, and Tony was incredibly generous with his time and told me a little bit about, you know, how he got into things and working in commercials and what a terrific way that was to sort of build up the experience that you needed to do feature films. So I took his advice. He gave me loads of contacts back in London, and I went to London and and started my career doing commercials out there.
Wow.
You know, like Puss in Boots. You know?
That's terrific. So going back to Sam Rockwell, we talked about that you wrote it for him. So there were three characters in this movie, but only one actor on screen for its entire running time. Sam Rockwell, as you might infer, is in almost literally every frame of the movie, which would necessitate a whole lot of creativity considering. Yeah. So how did you begin to work out the technicals with him acting against himself?
Well, I mean, there are very few actors that you could actually pull something like this off with. Sam is a very unique actor in that, for me at least, in my experience, anything I've ever seen him in, he just steals the scene. He steals the frame.
Even Galaxy Quest, where he's a very small character.
Absolutely. He does it all the time. You know, Green Mile, Charlie's Angels, any of these support parts he's done, he's always stolen the frame. And then when he does get the chance to lead in something like Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, he's got so much variety and so much energy and so much he's willing to try and do. It just keeps you entertained and it keeps you watching. So I thought, I just felt comfortable that he could do it. But, you know, it wasn't until I had the chance to do the rehearsals with him and really work with him that I saw just how he was able to do it and the things that he did. And the fact that he used so much improv. He comes from an acting background using the Meisner technique. Basically, it's a technique of acting where it's very much reactionary and you bounce off and use the energy of the person you're performing with. Obviously, in our case, that became a real difficult, you know, a stumbling block, a real difficult situation for how to give him that when he doesn't have anyone to act, to perform with. So we came up with some techniques which actually ended up working really well in the end that would still give him the opportunity to improv. We had sort of a couple of actors sort of on standby who were with us on the set, one of whom was a body double, a very young actor just out of acting school called Robin Chalk. And sometimes he would perform against Robin, and Robin would keep far enough back that he sort of wouldn't interfere with the frame of whatever it was we were shooting.
Oh, I see.
And then we had another guy, I think his name was Gary Condes, who was also trained in Meisner, and was able to give Sam a little bit more of the sort of the back and forth of the energy that he needed to sort of get him into scenes. But Sam, you know, it was nerve-wracking for Sam because until he actually saw the effect working, he was really nervous about how all of this was going to come together.
Sure.
So the first week of shooting, there was not really any evidence for him to sort of get to grips with what it was we were doing. And things were very, you know, we were getting through the scenes that we needed to, but there was this real nervousness on set. And I know that Sam could really, you know, Sam was really struggling, I think, to deal with it and to feel comfortable with what it was we were doing. But we had this terrific VFX special effects supervisor on board, a guy called Simon Stanley Clamp, and he came in and by the end of the first week he was able to actually comp together a rough cut of what one of these two Sam scenes would look like when we showed it to Sam, and all of a sudden it clicked and Sam sort of got all the confidence. It was like, oh my god, it looks great, I understand what you're doing now. And from that point on, Sam really just became so much less inhibited and just let go and just went with it, and it was a marked change in the approach and what we were doing on the set from that point onwards.
We have acknowledged how awesome an actor Sam Rockwell is.
Oh, absolutely.
As the story goes on, his character / characters become much more intense, and the emotions start to really rage and grow deep. Were either of you prepared for what you ultimately got, or was that what you'd planned to get?
No, I mean, I think we knew there was some sort of backstory stuff going on while we were shooting the film. Sam and I, very similar guys, roughly the same age. you know, both come from this sort of, again, slightly unique background of having quite arty parents and being only kids ourselves. So we had a lot of similarities, a lot of common feelings about how to approach the roles. We were both going through long distance relationships at the time as well. Our girlfriends were both on the other sides of the world.
Oh,
So that was, you know, that really sort of fed itself into the kind of story we were telling. So it was very easy for both of us to sort of quickly communicate to each other what it is that we wanted in the scene. And we always knew we wanted a lot of heart in it, because there was, you know, there was a lot of emotions going on for me and Sam and our two girlfriends at the time anyway. It was all kind of there and ready to get out and to communicate.
I want to talk for a moment about the music by Clint Mansell. Oh, yeah. And it's performed by Orphans of the Storm.
Yeah.
Really interesting music choices. It's, again, hearkening back to movies like 2001, which, not in a classical sense necessarily, but there's an experimental sound running through Moon, along with a sort of a lonely piano motif that keeps recurring.
Yeah.
So what did you set out to do with the music? Did you get what you wanted?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I knew that I really wanted to work with Clint. I mean, almost as much as I wanted to work with Sam. You know, it was that important to me. I'd known Clint before I actually worked on the film. And it was one of those opportunities again where I knew Clint and was able to get directly to him, because his agent would never have allowed, I think, him to do a film of such a low budget film as ours. Mm. But I was able to get, you know, around the agent, and Clint attacked from one side and I attacked from the other, and we were able to sort of get everyone to agree that it would be a good thing to do. But Clint is fantastically talented, and I love everything that he does. And when we were doing the rough cut of the film, we were using bits of Requiem for a Dream and some of his other scores as placeholder. So I kind of knew up front that I wanted to get him, and it was just going to be whether we could convince him to do it.
But you said, yeah, I want to do something that doesn't sound, it's not an orchestral score at all.
No, it's just, I mean, that's very much what Clint, I think, brings to writing scores for film. He's just got a very unique voice. And I think he's really important in that industry right now.
This is, you know, see, you run out of time before you run out of questions. Duncan Jones has been with us here on Celluloid Dreams. He is the director of Moon, starring Sam Rockwell. Awesome, awesome film, dude.
Thank you.
You have a lot of great things ahead of you, and this is just your first film.
Thank you very much.
I'm Larry Jacobetz for Celluloid Dreams, 90.5 KSJS, online at celluloiddreams.net.